Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forsey. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin at Carleton University, Norman Patterson School of International Affairs, high above the Rideau River, where, Stephanie, I'm pleased to announce that there's a significant amount of snow going on right now.
It's supposed to rain later in the week. It wouldn't want to rain on your snow parade, geez. Craig.
Well, we can only hope for the best. So, Stephanie, what
it's
are
a good theme for today, Craig.
What are we talking about today?
Well, funny you should say that. So, Canada has found itself between the U.S. and China.
Between the eagle and the dragon.
Oh, my good gravy. It's not a great place for a mouse to be, is it?
Although the prime minister has compared us to a moose in response to the Trump tariffs.
That's some creative thinking, but I'm not sure it's accurate. Either way, basically, we're going to be focusing this issue on this event that has occurred last week, the arrest of Miss Meng of Huawei. She was the chief financial officer. She was on her way to Mexico via Vancouver. There was a U.S. request to provisionally arrest Miss Meng, and she was. And now China's very mad at us. So there's a whole host of issues here. I mean, there's so much. I mean, there's a whole Huawei issue to begin with. But we're going to focus it today on the implications of this particular arrest. And because of all the kind of speculation we've seen on Twitter, I think we want to be careful and walk through what could be at stake in what the U.S. charges actually are. As well, we're going to look at the extradition law here in Canada, which is poorly understood. But fortunately, you have done two interviews for us.
We're going to start with my former colleague from Hughes, Hubbard & Reed, the firm I practiced with in Washington, D.C. back in the dark ages, Alan Cashton, who's an expert in export controls and sanctions law in the United States. And he knows nothing more than we do. And so he's relying on the material in the press. But he has some thoughts on what sort of sanctions laws issues might be in play in this case and the charges brought against Ms. Meng. And then we're going to segue into a conversation with my colleague, University of Dalhousie law professor Rob Curry, who is going to talk about extradition law and how it works. And I think one of the takeaways from that conversation, while there is a judicial component, and we're seeing part of that judicial component right now, this is a very political process, much more political than would be the case, say, in a conventional criminal trial in Canada. And that's important to take into account in this conversation, since this is overtly now a political controversy in which Canada finds itself square between the United States and China. But before we do that, just before getting Alan to weigh in on the U.S. law issues, I thought it might be useful just, Stephanie, to summarize what's in the documents that have been filed by the Crown, who is acting on behalf of the United States in what is presently a bail hearing in Vancouver, in which Ms. Meng's liberty is at issue. And so the question is to whether she'll be released pending whatever proceedings the Americans want to undertake in terms of her extradition. That's currently undecided as we record this. But in the documents, so she is, as you noted, the daughter of the founder of Huawei and currently serves as the deputy chairman of the board in addition to her role as chief financial officer. More than that, she also served on the board of the Hong Kong-based Skycom Tech Company. Skycom is a name which will come up in these conversations. Between February 2008 and 2009, and according to financial statements from Skycom, in that period up until 2010, the principal activities of Skycom involved investment holding and acting as a contractor for contracts undertaken in Iran. And that becomes important because the gravamen of the allegation here is that Ms. Meng conspired, in essence, with this company, Skycom, to do an end run around U.S. sanctions law. Now, it's a bit unclear as to whether we were talking about a technology transfer, that is, a transfer of U.S. technology. In the conversation with Alan, we talk about the implications of that for U.S. sanctions law. What seems to be coming more clear as we proceed is that at issue here is a financial transaction involving banks who were induced or encouraged to undertake transactions that would violate U.S. sanctions law. And so it's a financial transaction issue, and that implicates an organization on the U.S. side that Alan will mention called the Office of Financial Asset Controls, OFAC, and some of the financial sanctions that surround banking in the United States. Why don't we have Alan weigh in and give some thoughts on what he sees to be some of the U.S. legal issues here.
Sounds like a plan.
There are actually three things that I've read, and I also don't know the details. Apparently, there was an arrest warrant issued somewhere in the Southern District of New York, but what is in that warrant, as far as I'm aware, is not public. And I have also seen the references to Iran and sanctions. But in terms of criminality, there are two distinct possibilities. One is not Iran-related, although the underlying activity in either case is Iran-related. And one is Iran-related. First, during the time period when this allegedly took place, which I guess would have been probably before the JCPOA. I'm guessing it was in the 2013-14 time period, maybe. We had our full embargo in force, including secondary sanctions, but the primary sanctions are under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, which has civil and criminal penalties. Another aspect that I've seen referred to is that Ms. Meng allegedly made false statements to U.S. banks, which the reference I've seen is HSBC, which itself was subject to a massive OFAC settlement with hundreds of millions of, if not a billion plus, of penalties. And they had a monitor put in charge of them for a few years. And the monitor apparently reported a concern that Ms. Meng allegedly lied about an alleged connection between Huawei and a company in Hong Kong called Skycom. Now, I don't know who was allegedly exporting or possibly exporting goods to Iran that shouldn't have been, whether it was Skycom or Huawei, and whether those goods were 100% U.S. origin goods in violation of U.S. re-export controls, or if they were Chinese-made goods that had, in the case of Iran, more than 10% U.S. content, which would also make them subject to U.S. re-export controls. And if the violation was deemed to be criminal, IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, could have been the basis of a allegation of criminal activity. The other thing I've seen is with this lying to the bank. I'm not a bank law expert, but my understanding is that it is a criminal offense to lie to a bank in connection with a banking transaction. In fact, I'm sure even in Canada, you've heard of Michael Cohen, the president's personal fixer lawyer. And one of the things he was indicted for in the Southern District of New York was lying to banks about the purpose for taking out a loan to pay Donald Trump's alleged mistresses. And that in itself would be a felony, lying to a bank. Now, if she lied to a bank about this connection between Skycom and Huawei, that could be a banking law felony, wholly apart from export control. But the reason that the two may be interlinked is that if HSBC in the U.S. was aware that whatever the underlying transaction was that prompted Ms. Meng to lie to the bank was related to Iran, they would have said, we can't do it because we're prohibited as a U.S. bank from being involved in Iranian transactions. So there could have been violation of banking laws and of export control laws. And even if there was no U.S. content to what they were doing, if there was a dollar denominated or dollar payable aspect of the transaction, which would in most cases have to clear through the U.S. financial system, a U.S. bank couldn't do that if Iran was on the other end of the transaction, even if there was no U.S. content here. So those are the things that, from what I've read, might be in play, but I haven't seen in any more detail than you have from what the Globe and Mail or Wall Street Journal or Reuters has reported.
So she would potentially be culpable even if this took place entirely extraterritorially and had no contact with the territory of the United States?
Yes, because the U.S. export controls are extraterritorial in effect, and they do apply to re-exports from outside the U.S. of U.S.-made goods as well as exports of foreign-made goods that have more than 10% U.S.-controlled content. And under the sanctions rules, that last thing I was speaking about, the payable through a U.S. bank to clear a dollar transaction, any person, the prohibition in the Iran sanctions regulations, one of them is causing a violation. And that causing can be done by anyone. You don't have to be a U.S. person to be liable for violating the thou shalt not cause a violation of the regulations. And by hiding the or allegedly concealing the Iranian connection, HSBC may have been tricked into participating in the action in this transaction, thereby at least nominally violating the sanctions, and she could be the cause of that by having lied.
What are the penalties like if any of these possibilities are in fact what happened?
Well, the IEEPA penalties are, for criminal penalties, up to $1 million per violation and or 20 years in prison. And depending on how many transactions there were that may have been financed or paid through HSBC, if that's the violation, each one of those could be a separate violation. People sometimes go to jail. I'd be shocked if she went, but you know, if they want her extradited, they assume they want to try her. She obviously, her family could pay big fines, but they may want to make an example. I don't know. No, I've never heard of anyone going to jail for 20 years. for an export control violation, but people do go to jail in serious cases.
Well, that's great. That's very helpful. Thanks very much, Al. So Stephanie, a couple of things just to highlight there. I spoke to Alan yesterday, so that would have been Monday. And what's become clear with some of the court documents that have been released through the media just today is that the focus really is on this fraud charge and the banking aspect that Alan was talking about. It doesn't seem that this was a technology transfer issue. And so that probably will have implications as we talk to Rob on the extradition side. The financing and fraud stuff is probably easier to make stick than if this was a pure you violated American sanctions law in terms of technology transfer. Because while we have our own sanctions law, including the Special Economic Measures Act or SEMA, which Rob will mention, those sanctions laws don't necessarily overlap all that directly with the US provisions. And of course, they're very political. You know, who are you going to sanction in what circumstance? And so the fact that those sorts of decisions are very political could have a bearing on extradition for reasons that we'll chat to Rob about. So the fraud charge seems to be the one that will transfer best in terms of finding a concomitant Canadian offense. Because as we'll discuss, for extradition provisions, if you're going to extradite someone to face charges overseas, it has to be for something they can be charged with here in Canada.
Right. So yeah, there has to be, I believe you call it the dual criminality.
Correct.
Right. And so that's what effectively the Crown is now looking to prove.
Yes. The dual criminality requirement is one of the issues that comes up very early in the extradition proceeding. And so why don't we turn to Rob now and have him discuss the basic parameters of the extradition law and some of its pros and cons. And then we'll dive a little bit deeper into some of the specifics around how this might unfold.
It's been an interesting couple of years for extradition. This has the potential to be maybe the biggest extradition case we've ever had, but there's been scrutiny of the act because of the case of Hassan Diab, which you've discussed on your program before and your listeners, I bet, are familiar with. This particular case doesn't raise the same kinds of issues, but it's shining a spotlight on this sort of obscure area of quasi-constitutional international administrative law with a criminal flavor to it, which, as you said, is quite obscure. So I think the starting point maybe is at the international level, because extradition is done predominantly by way of bilateral treaty between states which are like-minded in wanting to cooperate. And what they're cooperating on, of course, is the transfer of individuals from one territory to another. Your paradigmatic extradition target is an individual who committed a crime in one country and then fled to the neighboring country or indeed some other country. And you do, of course, have situations like the one we're faced with Ms. Meng, where she was, in fact, changing planes in Vancouver, but the extradition request had come in, or at least an arrest request had come in, and we'll talk about the difference there. And they grabbed her while she was on Canadian territory because she was wanted in our partner state. So the extradition treaty, and in this case it's the Canada-US treaty, is implemented by way of the Extradition Act. And all of our extradition arrangements are implemented by way of the Act. And I say arrangements because we don't do it all by way of treaty. There are sort of standing agreements and old common law hangovers, but we'll think of it as predominantly a treaty exercise for the moment. So what happens and what has happened in this case is that the U.S. has taken advantage of a provision in the treaty that allows it to ask for provisional arrest of an individual for whom they expect to make an extradition request in the near future. But it would suggest that they needed more time to get all of their ducks in a row. And the Act has that right in it, so that the Crown can get a warrant for the arrest of the individual based on the forthcoming extradition request. So that appears to be what's happened here. And then after the arrest is complete, you're walking through a procedure that is fully set out in the Act. So the Act is one-stop shopping for extradition. There's some, of course, common law interpretation of it, but the whole regime is contained there. And the ordinary court sees exactly what we've seen here. There is a bail hearing. And the individual either is granted bail or is not, and we'll certainly talk about that. After that, the two major phases are there's a court phase and there's a phase that the Minister of Justice presides over. The court phase, as many of your listeners will know, is called the committal hearing, and that's the point at which a superior court judge asks a series of questions. It's a fairly perfunctory kind of thing. It's really more checking off boxes than anything else, even though it's contested whether or not it should be so, and we'll definitely get into that today. After the judge has decided that there are no legal barriers around the evidence, the nature of the request, or the crime for which the person is sought, the process shifts to the minister. And this is the Minister of Justice acting in her capacity as the Minister of Justice, which is to say, not the Attorney General. And that's a different set of tasks, again, as your listeners will know. So the minister is charged under the Act with making the ultimate decision about whether or not the individual is to be surrendered to the requesting state. And there are a number of considerations there. There are certain situations where the minister is, in fact, prohibited by the Act from ordering surrender, such as where there's discrimination in play. And there are a number of discretionary grounds as well that the minister may or may not exercise. I guess the last legal procedural piece to it is that both the court decision and the minister's decision are subject to review, which is to say the court decision can be appealed to the relevant provincial court of appeal, and the minister's decision can be subject to judicial review before the same court of appeal. Typically, those are rolled into one hearing, and they all take place, which is good for efficiency reasons. And then ultimately, cases can and sometimes do end up at the Supreme Court of Canada. And that's after that, if the Crown's case is successful, which it almost always is, surrender takes place unless something unusual happens after the fact.
So, Stephanie, first of all, and this is going to come out in our conversation going forward, this is an unusual process, right? This is not just the prosecutor turns up, charges against an individual, there's an adjudication, an adversarial adjudication in front of an independent judicial officer or judge who determines guilt or innocence. That's not what extradition is about. It's not a mini trial on the merits. Instead, it's a process for removing someone to the country so they can be tried overseas. And so when Rob says that the Minister of Justice is acting in their capacity as the Minister of Justice and not the Attorney General, our Minister of Justice actually wears two hats, Justice Minister hat and Attorney General hat. And the
one being a political role and the other one being the role of being kind of Canada's top lawyer.
Yeah, essentially. And so for the Minister of Justice, it's not just a political role, it's the administration of justice generally. But here, they're executing a requirement under a treaty as articulated in the Extradition Act. They're not acting as an independent Crown prosecutor who is supposed to be endowed with prosecutorial independence. The Attorney General is, and though the way we work things now, it's not actually the Minister of Justice as Attorney General who stands up in the courtroom and prosecutes people. In fact, there's even an arm's length relationship now between prosecutors and the Attorney General. But the bottom line is that this is an overtly policy/political role as manifested through a specific statutory instrument that is the Extradition Act. And we're going to come back to that because I think there's some misunderstanding in the public mind about that. The process we're in right now is much more judicial, right? Because she's been arrested provisionally and there's a bail proceeding, and that bail proceeding will be decided in the court. And so we are at an initial stage which looks and walks and talks a lot like our typical courtroom proceedings. And so we'll ask Rob about how that bail proceeding might turn out before turning into how quickly after the bail proceeding this system of extradition starts to look a lot different from a criminal trial.
Well, it's a fairly standard bail exercise the way you would see play out in our domestic criminal courts. You know, is there a surety who can be provided to guarantee the individual will both stay in the jurisdiction and will comply with whatever the restrictions are? There are questions around what the restrictions are going to be. You know, is it a house arrest kind of situation, or can they be abroad in the community? Do they have to wear electronic monitoring and so on? In extradition bail proceedings, the bell of is the person a flight risk is rung with more force, you might say, because naturally we are talking about somebody who we know at least on one occasion in the past has been in another country, and that has to be considered whether they may indeed flee Canada as they are alleged to have fled the other jurisdiction. In this case, that is huge. It's got to be the biggest issue that they're talking about at the bail hearing, because the Crown has argued, according to the reporting, that Ms. Meng is definitely a flight risk. I'm not trying to put words in their mouth, but she's got more money than Croesus, and she has 7 passports. She's very much a citizen of the world, with only limited ties to Vancouver. And, of course, the support, even if it is slightly surreptitious, of the Chinese government, it's, you know, very much an open secret who she is, the family she comes from, and their position within the overall Chinese governance infrastructure. On the other hand, the defense, of course, is arguing, look, it would look terrible for this very reputable executive to skip bail in a country where, you know, we take criminal procedure seriously. We have human rights protections. There's no reason to believe she's going to be mistreated or anything like that. She has no reason to run. I've seen bits and pieces about her having a husband in Vancouver, having two houses there, some suggestion that a child who goes to school there, that sort of thing. So I often find bail results easy to call. I don't find this one easy to call at all.
Is there a prospect that Canada could have turned a blind eye on the American request? And did we really have to get as far as even this deliberation over bail?
Well, formally speaking, no, in the sense that we have an obligation under the treaty to act in good faith to complete the request. You know, the request was for provisional arrest. Assuming all the boxes were ticked in that request from the U.S., then our legal obligation under the treaty is simply to go ahead and do it. John Manley said an interesting thing in a panel the other day where he said this might have been a good instance of, or a useful time for Canada to have exercised a bit of, I can't remember the phrase he used exactly, but creative incompetence or something like that. Essentially say, oh, we know we got to the airport, we were 2 minutes late and she had already left, because it would have avoided putting us in the middle of this massive proxy war between the U.S. and China, which is being fought on so many fronts. And this, our extradition law, our relatively obscure extradition proceeding, has become one of the battlegrounds.
So let's assume we've got a conclusion to the bail hearing, and let's assume that she's kept in custody. She's incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So what happens now? Do the Americans have to proceed?
Do they have to proceed? No. In fact, they can withdraw the request at any point. And I've been asked a number of times this week, if you were advising the Prime Minister or the Justice Minister about this, what would you advise? And I really said, the process is going to take a while to play out, but the most useful thing to me would be back-channel communications with the U.S. and China and say, look, if the two of you can work this out between yourselves, that would be great, because it would save us from being in the middle of this situation. But we can imagine a situation, at least, where the U.S. would simply withdraw the extradition request, whatever form it is taken by that point, and then the thing would be over, and Canada could release Ms. Meng from custody, and off she would go to Mexico or wherever she was heading for at the time. So they don't have to carry forward with it. If they do, though, we are caught in that sort of pincher's effect.
So we're into a committal proceeding then, if they decide to proceed, am I right?
That's exactly right. Maybe some preliminary issues leading up to that. If, for example, if she is unsuccessful on bail, they may appeal that. I think you can appeal the bail decision under the Act. But the next major point is the committal hearing. And that's the point where we're really hitting one of the pressure points in our law in terms of how it operates and how heavily slanted it is towards extradition. And that really was the ultimate goal of the government from the get-go when they reformulated the Extradition Act in 1999, which was to make extradition easier, make the procedure more streamlined. The result, though, that we've gotten is that the thresholds to be met by the requesting state are so low that they're barely thresholds at all. And as Anne Laferre wrote in a very prescient article back when the Act first came in, the committal judge is essentially almost a rubber stamp type figure. There's very little for that judge to do because all the requesting state has to do is to present a few items, like one, identification of the individual. Yes, this is the person who is being sought. Second, they need to present, as they usually do, a record of the case, which is a summary of the evidence that they've got that would tend to support the charge that they're after. Again, fairly modest threshold there. Wrapped up in that is the double criminality requirement, which is to say the crime for which she is being sought in the requesting state is something we also recognize as a crime here in Canada. Now, this is a case that I thought earlier it might be a huge issue. I think less so now because the American case appears to be based in fraud. And we've got, you know, very recognizable fraud kind of offenses. That's not very contentious.
Just to understand the basis for the case. So you and I have both seen the documents that CTV put on their webpage that summarizes the American case. And as I understand it, it sounds like this case stems from financial sanctions that were imposed by the U.S. government on Iran. It sounds like the investigation started in 2009. So this would have been during the period in which Iran was being sanctioned under UN, but also under unilateral U.S. sanctions among other things, for its participation in a nuclear weapons development program. And the American sanctions seem very sweeping in terms of financial limitations on banking with Iranian entities or persons in Iran. And from the sounds of it, to do an end run around these requirements, Huawei had some sort of arrangement with another entity, which was said to be unaffiliated, but really wasn't, that served therefore as sort of a conduit for a continuation of financial dealings with the international banking system. That seems to be the, as I understand it, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but that seems to be the core of the allegation here. And so the question I have, Robin, and maybe you've given us some thought, is, you know, I've been leafing through trying to figure out what equivalent sanctions we had in place on Iran back in, you know, say, 2009, when it seems that this investigation began. And it seems to me, not having spent much time on this, that our financial sanctions were less sweeping in their scope than were the American ones. And so the American ones are basically no financial dealings. Ours are, you know, no financial dealings with designated entities, or at least tied to the concern about proliferation or weapons sales and the like. If that were true, if there is a disparity between the scope of our financial sanctions that were in place at the material times, Canadian and American, would that raise an issue for dual criminality?
That's the million-dollar question. And it may literally be a million-dollar question, because I suspect both sides will spend a lot of money on this case if it goes all the way through. The way I read it is that the sanctions regime is essentially the backdrop. It's the factual backdrop to the charges. The charges are based in fraud, essentially, and conspiracy to defraud the lenders by way of using the allegedly unrelated company, you know, which the Americans are saying was just a proxy for Huawei itself, as a way of getting around the sanctions. So, you know, that's the factual part of the fraud, but it's the, you know, it's the dishonesty in the way the separate company was presented that seems to be what they're going after. And I have no doubt that they have framed it that way because they want to skirt the issue of how different our regime is under the Special Economic Measures Act from, you know, the way the sanctions would have been laid out there. I mean, you'd be crazy to want to go down that road. I think it would introduce a lot of complexity. That said, it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility that the defense will dig in to that and say, well, look, you know, fraud in this context is something that that would not fly in Canada. But the deck is really stacked against them at the committal hearing, because the dual criminality requirements are so mild and milquetoasty. It's simply a matter of the judge being able to look at it and say, if any combination of this conduct could be found to be criminal in Canada, that's enough. That makes out double criminality. So I think it will definitely be a flashpoint in the case if the thing goes forward. But very difficult to get over it the way the thresholds are built at the moment.
One other question, Rob, on sort of a geeky a question for law aficionados. So if this is a plain vanilla fraud, or at least a fraud predicated on sanctions, I'm not sure that our regular fraud provisions, say, in the criminal code would reach purely extraterritorial conduct. That is, a conduct that had no nexus to Canada whatsoever, whereas the American provisions seem to. Do you think this question of they have extraterritoriality, we don't, we would require a nexus to the territory of Canada to make out the fraud claim, that puts this question of double criminality in a different light than it might otherwise be?
Well, that one's a bit easier in that the question of the jurisdictional reach over the crime is explicitly indicated in the Act as a responsibility of the minister. The way I think it plays out is this: the minister is free to factor into her decision, we don't exercise that kind of extraterritoriality over this offense, and therefore, on that basis, I'm declining the extradition request. And that, I think, is to give it's a bit of a pressure valve for situations where the requesting state has jurisdictional overreach, and the federal government as a whole is worried about supporting that. You know, it might be a really tenuous basis for jurisdiction, and they say, we don't want that floating around out there in state practice. We don't want to be seen to be sanctioning that. So that's available. It's totally within the minister's view. And to my knowledge, that said, it's never been invoked by the minister. The minister's never shown any appetite for refusing extradition requests, particularly American extradition requests, on that basis.
So that would be the second prong of this process. Before we get to the second prong, on the committal hearing, you mentioned the Hassan Diab case, where, of course, the courts played a significant role, at least in adjudicating the merits. In that case, it was the French presenting evidence, use the term lightly, intelligence of various quality, suggesting that Mr. Diab was associated with a bombing in the early 1980s in Paris. Of course, that case has ultimately turned into a debacle in France itself, and Mr. Diab is now back in Canada after the French courts concluded, at least thus far, that there was no merits to them. So is that where the court might be in a position to exercise some oversight? If you had a case like that where the foreign country's evidence is rudimentary, would that arise in the committal process?
It arises in the sense that the defense has at least a nominal ability to say that the evidence that is being presented by the requesting state is manifestly unreliable. That came out of the Ferris case in 2006, where the Supreme Court tried to keep the committal phase from just being a rubber stamp. And they said, look, a meaningful process means that the judge has the ability to turn back a case if it's based on unreliable evidence. In the case law before and since, though, it has become clear that it's barely a practical possibility for the individual sought even to be allowed to lead evidence about the quality of the requesting state's evidence. And where they do, the law has been interpreted so that manifest unreliability is a bit of a brass ring that nobody can reach. You know, practically no cases are ever resolved on that basis, or at least they don't go away on that basis, unless the requesting state's case has fallen apart completely. You know, they can be shown to actually not have evidence. But it's a terrible hill for the individual sought to climb. So it's not really practical consideration.
So that means that this case is not going to end and die at the committal hearing. It would be very unlikely it would be.
Extremely.
And so that means we're going to get to that second prong, which sounds very political.
It's funny, you know, it is political. And I've been noticing in the last days that the government's messaging on this case has been very much, look, we have independent courts, we have an independent judiciary, these decisions are made in accordance with our legal process, really de-emphasizing the idea that there's anything political in this. And of course, you know, that's a logical diplomatic response to the Chinese, who are saying the entire thing is politically motivated. But the interesting thing about extradition is that the minister has an explicit legislative mandate to consider political factors as part of the decision. The courts give great deference to the minister's surrender decision because she factors into it not just, you know, what's the nature of the request and is this something that we extradite for, but also Canada's political relations with our extradition partners. The need for those relations to go smoothly, the need for overall transnational crime cooperation to go smoothly. So there's an explicit political portion there. And it's a fine line, I think, for the minister to walk, because it's not a purely legal question. It must comply with the charter, because the charter is meant to infuse the entire process. And yet the minister enjoys the most deferential standard of review known to administrative law, I think, in making this decision. So even the charter becomes a much less powerful device there. So that part of it is fascinating. The standard practice of the minister, of course, has been to argue before the courts anytime that it's reviewed that this is the most important part of the entire process, you know, which slides the courts over to the deferential end of the scale. So there, in this case, though, it's an entirely different kind of matter, because the minister's got political considerations of various stripes and various flavors.
So you mentioned the charter. Typically in a case that involves the removal of a Canadian, one of the charter considerations would be Section 6, which is the right of a Canadian to enter and leave and by extension also remain in Canada. That's not in place here because the person at issue is obviously not Canadian and in fact doesn't have a residency even in Canada. It's not a citizen. The other charter issue that comes up sometimes is Section 7, that is right to life, liberty, security of the person in relation to fundamental justice. And there, of course, issues have arisen around torture. And so if the removal is to the torture or also the death penalty, those are circumstances which might trigger Section 7. And that would be true for any individual, not just a national, not just a Canadian. Here, of course, as best I know, I don't think the death penalty is on the table for this crime. And we're moving to a jurisdiction where there's no plausible basis to conclude that at issue is torture. And so those Section 7 interests that are at play often in the Charter don't seem to be applicable. Am I right?
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, the U.S. has a recognizable justice system that, in at least in its ordinary criminal justice system, doesn't make any use of torture, and the death penalty doesn't seem to be on the table. There's been a consistent argument over the years that American sentencing practices are quite harsh, and that is one that many, many individuals thought have tried on with the courts for years, but have gotten almost no success. There have been a few cases where I can think of one where there was an individual who faced a conviction for child sexual assault, but the issue was that after he completed his sentence, he would be poked into a form of civil administrative detention from which nobody ever actually emerged, even though you were supposed to be reviewed and eventually released. But it's unusual cases like that. What our courts have not had any appetite for has been people who say, look, the American sentence is too harsh. The response has tended to be a very conservative one along the lines of, well, you shouldn't have committed a crime in the U.S. then, you know, that's your fault. But that difficulty then compounded by this situation where you've got a totally extraterritorial crime over a foreign national who, if reports are to be believed, has made sure that she didn't touch American jurisdiction for the last few years.
So that raises one final issue. There have been some reporting in the American press suggesting that, as you indicated, this is another front in this proxy battle between the United States and China over Chinese economic Chinese economic circumstances and their geopolitical ambitions. And one of the things that has been mooted is that this is just a point of leverage that the Trump administration may be using to extract concessions from the Chinese and other venues. If that were the case, what would the prospect be of a serious challenge to this extradition proceeding on the basis that at issue is essentially a political offense, which, as I understand it, is a basis for declining extradition?
That's another interesting one. Yeah, that's a standard feature of extradition treaties, that extradition won't take place where the prosecution at issue is being done for a political purpose or where the crime is a political crime. It's tended more towards the latter. You know, I mean, the origin of the political offense exception was kind of internecine European battles where freedom fighters were running across borders constantly, and you didn't really want to be messing around in the politics of another, internal politics of another state. So you declined to extradite if it was a political question. Here, it's an international geopolitical question, but that doesn't mean that the policy idea behind the political offense doctrine is unavailable. The real barrier, again, I think, resides in the minister's discretion that she would exercise, because it's unheard of for Canada to refuse extradition on the basis of the political exception, even though it's listed as one of the minister's powers, and to do so to the U.S., vis-a-vis the U.S., would be punching the Trump administration in the nose. And of course, they're volatile and pugilistic at the best of times at the moment. So that it seems like it's exactly the kind of decision that the minister would prefer not to make.
So Stephanie, just a couple of follow-up observations on what Rob said. So this is a very political process.
Yeah, and I think I just want to highlight that because it's interesting. One of the things, like, I've been trying to say, at least to the media and as well as online, is that Canada is a rule of law nation, and that it's, you know, really important that we explain to the Chinese, just, we have a process, we have an independent court system. But at the end of the day, what I'm learning from Rob is actually just how political this really is. And that then makes our argument about the rule of law and things like this much more difficult, yeah. I think, at least to explain to the Chinese.
Yeah, certainly on the ministerial stage of this process, the Chinese, if they're paying attention, are probably appreciating that if they turn the political screws tightly enough, that might have a bearing on the outcome. And that has consequences for Canada. I have to say, if I was representing Ms. Meng, I might be saying to her, look, this is going to be a political decision, and so political means of influence are quite important when it comes to the outcome in this case. One final thought on extradition, because this is a recurring issue, extradition. So extradition has been controversial in the past, and I want to just mention two cases. Rob mentioned the case of Hassan Diab. That's Exhibit A in terms of some of the deficiencies in our extradition law, because there's no real prospect that the individual can challenge on the merits the claim being made by the foreign government. Another instance where this has been controversial is a case that never actually made it to court, and here's where dual criminality really became an issue. It's the case of Liman Hussein, who in the aftermath of 9/11 was involved in making money transfers through an informal network to Somalia. He was a Somali national originally and then became a Canadian. And the Americans, this money
transfer business was running through Massachusetts, I believe. And the Americans concluded that there was something amiss with this in relation to terrorism financing. And he was charged under a sort of obscure regulatory provision in terms of unlicensed money transfer in the U.S. And extradition was sought for him here in Canada in 2001. We didn't have any equivalent crime. This was before Bill C-36 and our modern terrorism financing provisions. There was actually no dual criminality there. And ultimately, the government of Canada concluded that there's no way that they could extradite him. Yeah, he actually settled an ultimate lawsuit against the government and was paid an undisclosed amount in compensation. So these cases can fall apart, but it's comparatively uncommon. Okay. So Stephanie, do you have any final thoughts on the national security implications of this case?
Yeah, I mean, I know we've gone through the law side of it. I mean, how unusual for us. But at the end of the day, I want to just acknowledge we've talked earlier this year about us becoming the runt of the litter internationally, right? And here we are caught between the United States and China. It's not clear if any country would come to our aid if we actually run into trouble. And today we're learning, of course, that China has in fact seized or detained a former Canadian diplomat who works for International Crisis Group in China. It's too soon to say whether this is a direct retaliation, but the timing is certainly suspicious and comes after China has made a specific specific unspecified threats towards Canada as a result of the actions it's taken against Ms. Meng. So I think that the context here is really serious, and I think more serious than perhaps what a lot of Canadians might at first realize. It's not just about us being caught between the United States and China, but also about what our future as a country is in terms of who we can depend on and who we can ally with at a time when America's turning more nationalist, more inwards, and a time when China's turning more aggressive. So I think that's one thing. I think there's could be a lot more to follow as well. China has a history of retaliating against Canada in a variety of ways. When the Dalai Lama spoke at the University of Calgary a few years ago, China actually de-recognized degrees from the University of Calgary for 1 year until they could negotiate a reinstatement. In the past, they've used canola and other agricultural exports as a kind of leverage. They always say, oh, your canola has black leg on it. Often at a time when trade talks are about to start as a way of kind of using some leverage as well. China has a history of using cyber attacks, not necessarily against Canada, although there's certainly been allegations of cyber espionage. But I don't think that would be the case here that you would see cyber attacks, if only because Huawei is trying to make the case that it's not going to engage in such behavior. And if it does, then, or if China does on its behalf, that argument becomes a little more difficult to make. But the other thing that I had anticipated and we may now be seeing is the hostage taking. And the detention of this individual may actually be that. And so the question is, how do we actually navigate this space? I was listening to Rob's suggestion, is this a good opportunity for us to be using back-channel diplomacy and quietly encouraging China and the United States to try and solve this, to try and get us out of this situation? I mean, there really doesn't seem to be any good place for Canada to turn now that this is happening. So it's a really challenging thing. I was very surprised when it happened. I wouldn't go so far as Mr. Manley in suggesting some kind of creative incompetence, but the fact that we took this step, the fact that the Prime Minister's office clearly knew that this was coming down and went along with it did surprise me substantially. And the implications of this with regards to either the future of Huawei in Canada, with regards to our future trade relationship with China, and a host of other kind of international questions is just kind of almost mind-boggling. And I'm sure this is not going to be the last time we talk about this case.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure that the Prime Minister's office could do anything about it in the sense that the extradition obligations were pretty clear at the outset. The politics is really at the back end. But I have to say, if I was a Canadian executive, I wouldn't be traveling to China anytime soon.
Yeah. And clearly today might just be the proof of that.
On that happy note,
see you next time.
We'll be back next day to talk a little bit more about cyber stuff because there's a lot happening in that space as well.
It's the whole other side of the Huawei story.